You're listening to a Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders 30th Anniversary Podcast. Founded in 1978, GLAAD is New England's leading legal rights organization dedicated to ending discrimination based on sexual orientation, HIV status, and gender identity and expression. For more information and updates on GLAAD's current legal work, visit us at glaad.org.
In July 1998, 24-year-old Lucas Rosa walked into Park West Bank in Holyoke, Massachusetts, to apply for a car loan. The bank's loan officer, Norma Brunel, sat down with Rosa and asked for three forms of photo identification. Rosa gave Brunel a Massachusetts Department of Welfare card, a Massachusetts identification card, and a money stop check cashing ID card. Brunel looked at each photo ID, looked at Rosa, and told Rosa to go home to change clothes. Only after that, Brunel said, would she give Rosa a loan application. Brunel's refusal brought Rosa and GLAAD to federal court in one of the first federal cases upholding the rights of transgender people. In GLAAD's 2000 victory, Rosa v. Park West Bank, the United States Court of Appeals for the First Circuit confirmed that sex discrimination laws extend to situations where people are discriminated against because they don't conform to stereotypes of how men and women are supposed to look and act. As later described in newspaper accounts, Rosa wore a beige sweater and black jeans when she went into Park West Bank and had made a special effort to look appropriate for a business setting. She resembled the photo in her check cashing ID, in which she wore makeup, earrings, and had ear-length red hair. But in Rosa's two other forms of ID, she presented differently. Her Massachusetts state ID photo was more gender ambiguous. She wore earrings but no makeup and had short brown hair. And in her Massachusetts welfare card photo, she looked more stereotypically male. GLAAD Transgender Rights Project Director Jennifer Levi, who later represented Rosa along with Civil Rights Project Director Mary Bonato, recalls what happened at the bank.
She presented, as she typically did, in a more female-gendered expression, and she was told by the loan officer to go home and come back when she looked like, and the loan officer pointed to the picture that was more stereotypically masculine. And she was told that she wouldn't get a loan application that day. So she went home and contacted an attorney who contacted me.
Levi says Rosa was embarrassed, so much so she didn't return to the bank. Rosa later told Planet Out News that, quote, "It was a humiliating experience to be told to change how I look in order to apply for a loan. No one should have to go through what I did, simply to receive routine service from a bank." Born biologically male, Rosa had been expressing a female gender identity since at least age 15. She told newspapers writing about the case that the Park West Bank incident was the first time her identification cards had been questioned. GLAAD quickly decided to take Rosa's case. As Levi notes, GLAAD wanted to bring a case that would establish protections for transgender people under federal law, because at that time, in 1998, none existed. The case also presented different facts from other cases that had been based on employment rather than lending practices. Jennifer Levi.
We took this case because in other cases, justifications had sometimes been offered about why someone had to look stereotypically masculine or stereotypically feminine that were tied to customer preferences or appropriate ways to look in the workplace. And none of those were appropriate legal justifications, but we knew that they could influence a court in issuing a decision. And so even though, for example, as I said, I mean, customer preferences is not a legitimate justification for race discrimination or sex discrimination or religious discrimination, we know that those are the kinds of justifications that can influence a judge to deny a claim, but frame it on some other basis. Here, it wasn't an employment context where the bank could suggest that other customers' prejudice was related to Rosa's credit worthiness, or that somehow her presentation would otherwise interrupt the bank's operations. It was exclusively about the prejudice of the loan officer. And so it was really a great case strategically to bring forward because it was stripped of any kind of business-oriented justifications for the discrimination.
GLAAD filed suit under the Federal Equal Credit Opportunity Act in federal district court, claiming that Rosa had been discriminated against on the basis of her sex. The ECOA was enacted by Congress in 1974 to ensure that all consumers have equal opportunity to apply for credit. The law specifically aimed to curb lending practices that refused credit to women applying without a male guarantor.
There's this beautiful language from the legislative history that says the reason why sex discrimination is prohibited in lending is because loan applicants should be judged on their credit worthiness, not on the perceptions of their credit worthiness that are associated with their sex. And really, Congress was influenced by the fact that women faced rampant discrimination in applying for loans, and many banks, for example, turned away single women because of a perception that they wouldn't be able to pay back a loan, and that, you know, if there wasn't a man associated or married to that woman, that they wouldn't be able to meet their financial obligations. And so it was this language about banks having to extend credit based on the credit worthiness of the applicant that really made this such a powerful case, because what Rosa looked like or what she was wearing that day or what she looked like at any other points in her life has nothing to do with her ability to pay back a loan.
The bank responded to Rosa's claim by saying that transgender people simply weren't protected under federal law. The Equal Credit Opportunity Act, they said, doesn't protect cross-dressers.
So the bank filed a motion to dismiss the case, relying on this well-established federal exclusion under the law for transgender people. And we responded, posed their motion to dismiss the case. And I remember, I have such a vivid memory of, well, I guess because it was my first argument in federal district court, and, you know, the bank said transgender people are excluded from federal law, and so they're therefore not protected, which, you know, I had become so strongly convinced of our argument that I couldn't believe that that was essentially all they were going to say, but they did. And so I got up and I made my argument about the fact that sex discrimination under federal law prohibits this kind of gender-based stereotyping, as well as making a more straightforward sex discrimination argument that since if she had been a female presenting in a female stereotypical way, she would have been given the loan, then she must have been discriminated against on the basis of her sex. And, you know, the judge nodded and seemed really receptive.
This was October 1999. In an unusual move, District Court Judge Frank Freeman said he would rule from the bench and returned with a ruling after half an hour of deliberation. He dismissed Rosa's claim. The issue in this case is not his sex, Freeman concluded, using a male pronoun to refer to Rosa, but rather how he chose to dress when applying for a loan. Because the act does not prohibit discrimination based on the manner in which someone dresses, Park West's requirement that Rosa change his clothes does not give rise to claims of illegal discrimination. Neither a man nor a woman can change their status from unprotected to protected simply by changing his or her clothing. GLAAD appealed to the First Circuit Court, arguing that, quote, the district court fundamentally misconceived the law as applicable to the plaintiff's claim by concluding that there may be no relationship, as a matter of law, between telling a bank customer what to wear and sex discrimination. Jennifer Levi remembers the argument.
The appeals court was actually, I mean, it was a very interesting argument, which I also recall as if it was yesterday. And the court seemed to pretty quickly at least reflect in its questions that the standard for dismissing a case was, you know, a very high standard for the bank, and that, you know, yes, it seemed like there were all kinds of facts that could potentially be proven about what the motivation of the loan officer was and why should we dismiss the case given how little development of it there has been. But beyond that, there was some very interesting questions that were asked by one of the judges about what it was that we were eventually going to be able to prove to show that there had been sex discriminatory motivations on the part of the loan officer in denying the loan. And this particular judge was especially focused on, for example, you know, what would it mean if the bank required women to look like women and men to look like men? Would that be sex discrimination? Or would that just be sort of equal treatment of both men and women, but in stereotypical ways.
On June 8, 2000, a 3-judge panel for the First Circuit reversed the district court's dismissal of the case. They ruled that there was no categorical exclusion of transgender people under the law, and that in Rosa's case, there could be facts that would prove the loan officer based her refusal on sex in some way. The case was in too early a stage to be dismissed outright. Rosa was one of the first rulings by a federal appellate court that said transgender people could be protected under the law. Other cases had been litigated, says Levi, but they hadn't been won.
They'd been consistently lost. There had been some very significant legal changes since cases in the 70s and early 80s in which transgender people were categorically excluded. There was a case that went up to the United States Supreme Court called Hopkins versus Price Waterhouse, which was not a case involving a transgender person at all, but a woman who worked at the accounting firm of Price Waterhouse and was denied partnership. And part of the comments that were made to her to support the denial of partnership was the fact that she didn't wear enough makeup, that she should go to charm school, that she should try wearing some high heels, and that she just basically didn't meet the stereotype of what Price Waterhouse would have for a woman working in that environment. The United States Supreme Court said that that kind of sex stereotyping was impermissible sex discrimination. And it was that case which was really at the heart of a number of legal academics developing a theory about ways to bring cases on behalf of not just transgender people, but also gender nonconforming gay people, particularly gay men. And so the litigators, you know, were beginning to think about ways to develop that academic argument in a practical way. And this was really one of the first of those cases.
In an amicus brief in Rosa, Catherine Franke, professor of law and director of the Gender and Sexuality Program at Columbia Law School, noted the shared and quite common experiences of people who face discrimination because of sex stereotyping. Rosa's case was far from odd, marginal, or hybrid in some exotic way, she wrote. Instead, her treatment at the hands of the Park West Bank loan officer reflected an everyday occurrence for countless people who failed to conform to rather traditional gender norms, notably something experienced more often by people who get caught displaying inappropriate femininity. Rather than understand Rosa's experiences lying well beyond the bounds of laws relating to sex stereotyping, she is better understood as a sort of canary in the sartorial coal mine. She was simply the most visible victim of systematic gender norms that regulate all of us in the ways in which we coherently present ourselves to the world as men or women. Since Rosa, Levi says there have been a number of decisions in federal appellate courts where transgender people have been explicitly protected under federal law. There are no explicit statutory protections for transgender people under federal employment prohibitions, but possible protections under both federal and state law are much more widespread than they were in 2000. Rosa has been a key precedent for federal courts in reversing the historic exclusion of transgender people from non-discrimination laws. As a victory at the federal level, Rosa was more visible than some other work Glad had done. But Glad has been working on transgender issues for nearly 3 decades. Glad has built on the foundation provided by its early work and by Rosa. Winning a transgender middle schooler the right to wear to school clothes consistent with her female gender identity, representing a transgender man fired from his job as a police officer, and fighting Medicaid's refusal to pay for breast reconstruction surgery for a transgender woman after she had a cyst removed. And in 2007, Glad argued in U.S. tax court on behalf of a transgender woman not allowed to deduct costs associated with her transition as a medical expense on her federal taxes. This work led GLAAD in June 2008 to launch its Transgender Rights Project, directed by Levi.
GLAAD's doing a lot of work at this point in a 3-part kind of way to try to ensure broader protections for transgender people. We're continuing to do the precedent-setting litigation that we have always historically done, but we're also really broadening the legislative advocacy that we have historically done. New England, it had in some ways led the country when Rhode Island passed its gender identity and expression explicit non-discrimination law in 2001. And since then, Vermont has passed a law, Maine has passed a law, but Massachusetts and Connecticut and New Hampshire remain states without explicit protections. And so there's a lot of advocacy that remains to be done, and education work to support the legislative changes. And then the third piece that we're really focusing on in, I think, a more intensified way now is public policy.
Specific priorities of the Transgender Rights Project will include ensuring access to health care, securing employment protections, and advocating for appropriate identity documents and standards for changing gender markers on them. GLAAD will also work with allies to raise the profile of transgender people in the public eye. This comprehensive strategy, grounded in GLAAD's 3 decades of advocacy for transgender people, will help us end discrimination based on gender identity and expression.
Thank you for listening to this GLAAD 30th Anniversary podcast. Visit GLAAD.org to learn more about this story and to download a new podcast on the 15th of every month.